Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You're listening to the Heroes Podcast Network. Hello and welcome back to Red Shirts and Runabouts, part of the Heroes Podcast Network. I'm one of your regular hosts, Greg Bosco, and with me as always is the very highly effective co-captain, Derek. Say hi, buddy.
Hey, everybody. Glad to be back. Good to see you, Greg.
Yeah, and just like normal, everybody, we're going to be starting off with some Trek news, discuss the Ready Room, discuss the Jonathan Frakes interview before we dive into the second episode of Discovery, New Eden. A name that hides nothing of the plot, obviously. You know, anything of Earth mysticism and lore, of course.
Yeah, this one was a little on the nose, but that was on purpose. They weren't really trying to hide the story, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously they have plans, and again, it's another throwback to like an old school original series episode.
Yes, very much so.
But Derek, you're a little bit more caught up on the news than I am. I was neglecting my duties due to a challenging toddler, so.
No worries.
Why don't you take the lead for a minute?
Sure. So first, I wanted to talk about the Ready Room. So for those of you out in the podcast world, that might mean a podcast series that you're familiar with from a wonderful network called Trek FM that's been going for several years. I'm not quite sure how long, but that's not the version that I'm about to talk about. This is the replacement for After Trek. So for those who followed Star Trek Discovery in its first season may remember that there was a after show like The Talking Dead that aired on CBS All Access basically directly after the episodes of Discovery. It was kind of an interview format show. There was a small audience, a very elaborate set, you know, lots of Star Trek-y stuff. They had the really expensive ship models out there. They'd bring, you know, crew and cast members on and things like that to talk about the show. And in the off season, it was announced that they were going to go a different direction. And After Trek, as we knew it, was not going to continue for season two. That was all we knew until very recently. Well, the replacement show, as we mentioned briefly last week or the week before, is a Facebook Live show, which means it actually airs on the Star Trek Discovery Facebook page. It's a video that they post directly to the page. So if you miss it, you have to kind of scroll a bit, which is honestly, I think, my only gripe about the first episode is that I had to find it. And it's short. It was only the first episode was 13 minutes, 58 seconds. It is an interview format show, but done much less formal and much less, put this delicately, it didn't feel fake or staged. So it's hosted by Naomi Kyle, who used to be a host over at IGN. She hosted The Daily Fix. I don't really know much about her other than really watching this episode, and she had on two guests, Alex Kurtzman, who most Star Trek people probably recognize the name. He was very involved in the Kelvin movies, and he is one of the co-creators and now showrunner of Discovery. And then Heather Caden, who is one of the executive producers of Discovery. They were the two guests. And the three of them sat in chairs. They were on a green screen with a pretty Starfield type background. And they just talked for 14 minutes. She interviewed them. She asked good, thoughtful questions, in my opinion. She asked a couple of questions that they didn't really want to answer, which at least made it appear that this was not heavily prepared ahead of time.
Well, and that's a good point, because that was one of the complaints of After Trek, was the show felt very kind of like almost canned. Like everything was so planned and so over the top, and you know, check out this clip. Woo! And you're like, all right, this is whatever. Just move on. Just
right.
Star Trek.
And like Naomi clearly seems to be a fan. She knows exactly what she's talking about. You know, she's into it. She seems engaged. Right. So this is, you know, she's prepared. It's more of like, I don't think Alex and Heather just like had a list of questions beforehand that were approved or anything. I think that she just respected who they were and vice versa. And they had a conversation. And, you know, there were a couple of questions that they didn't really give much of an answer to, like you would see in a normal interview, which I can appreciate. They did drop some cool information. First off, Jonathan Frakes, who directed New Eden, he also directed a couple episodes last season, will direct at least one more this season. Heather Caden confirmed that he's directing two. And the way that the exchange went, I'm not sure if she meant two total this season or two more this season. I'm not entirely sure which she meant by that. But so that's cool. We'll at least see Jonathan Frakes back in the director's chair one more time this season.
Yeah, it's always good to have old Trek alum involved in directing episodes because it just shows that they still care or they still want to see the franchise do well.
Well, Frakes is just so beloved in the fandom, you know, for even not just from us as the Trekkie fans, but also as the cast members and crew members. There's a bunch of stuff about him directing this episode. People just love him. He's not only, of course, does he know the franchise and know the material, but he's also a very accomplished and solid director. There was that big campaign when it was announced that J.J. Abrams was not directing the third Kelvin film, and they had not picked Justin Lin yet. They were still looking. There was a big campaign to have Jonathan Frakes return since he directed both First Contact and Insurrection.
Well, and you know, there's a lot of people that out there that believe that he directed the second or third best Star Trek film in First Contact. You know, my second favorite is, you know, Voyage Home, of course, but then number three is First Contact. And He's got talent. I mean, Insurrection, you know, purple Space Bazooka and, you know, the best of Target's summer clothing.
They definitely had they definitely seemed to be stretching the budget on that one a little bit. But I think still Frakes did a good job.
Yeah, it was he did fine.
Except for the scene, I talked about this when we reviewed it while you were away, but the scene where he activates the manual steering and that joystick comes up in the middle of the bridge.
Yeah, that doesn't really make any sense.
It's, forget sense, man. It looked terrible.
it definitely looked awful.
But anyway, so a couple other cool nuggets. Okay, so first off, they did want to put one particular rumor to bed, to rest, lay it to rest. There's apparently, and I'm not in this group, but there's apparently some people who had a feeling that the tension between Michael Burnham and Spock was romantic in nature.
Well, I was worried they were going to throw that in there, that Spock had feelings for her.
So no, not even remotely. According to Alex and Heather, it never even occurred to them.
Well, that's... And I hate to be that guy, but that's especially good considering the Kelvin universe with the Spock Uhura relationship. Is it basically means it's like, so he has a type? Like that's,
yeah.
That would be such lazy writing that even your generic Star Trek fan would be like, all right, that's just like compared to, you know, Deanna Troi's varied relationships of multiple different species and different types of men and different types of intelligence. It's like, nope, Spock just goes for the exact same type. Gorgeous women, intelligent women, strong women, but it would be lazy.
Well, luckily they're not going that route. The falling out that the two had will have something to do with that battle of, you know, emotion and logic and science and all of that. So,
well, good. And, you know, I think what people want, you know, a lot of fans enjoy is if there's romance in a show and it's done well, they like to see it be like grown organically. Mm-hmm. People meet, they fall in love. You know, Valana Torres and Tom Paris, at first they really didn't like each other. And they kind of grew on each other, they kind of developed respect, and they had a relationship. And you could say the same thing about, you know, Jadzia and Worf. Yeah, she was always fascinated with Klingons, and she always admired Klingons, but the relationship felt real. You got to see them grow together on screen. Versus, you know, the complaint I had about Spock and Uhura in 2009 was, bam, they just have a relationship. There's no growth. There's no development. It's just, you know what I mean? I like to see people grow together.
Yeah, it's one of the downsides of doing it in a movie format. You know, Trek, as I've said before, just kind of lends itself better to a serialized style.
Yeah, I mean, Picard and Bosch, for example, they had so much chemistry together.
Yeah.
In one episode, you can legitimately believe, you're like, they even act like a couple.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good example. So I'm glad
they put that rumor to rest, because that would have been, again, not bad, just lazy.
Agreed. A couple other things that they wanted to point out is there's going to be two more episodes of Short Treks coming up this spring that deal directly with season two in different ways, and they're both going to be animated in different styles from Lower Decks. It'll be completely different from the Lower Decks series.
It's kind of I'm getting a little bit of an Animatrix vibe. You remember that?
I had the exact same thought.
Oh, and you're watching Animatrix and you realize like there's 10 stories and the only one that anybody cares about is the one that has the war.
So like, for those who don't remember, way back when The Matrix was still a thing, they released the Animatrix, which was a series of, or a collection of several animated short films that were all done in a different style of animation.
Yeah, because you had everything from literal standard TV cartoon style to anime to Aeon Flux style.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bizarre attempt to maintain traction with the series.
It was interesting. And this doesn't sound like they're going that extreme. It sounds more of they just kind of want to be able to tell stories in a stylized way. And I really liked Short Treks. I thought it was super cool. If you watched The Ready Room, you'll know what I'm talking about. But if not, they did. I don't know if this would be a spoiler or not for a future episode, but one of the things in one of the Short Treks is going to come back around in a pretty significant way later this season. And that's super cool that they're doing that, because I thought they were interesting stories that they wouldn't normally be able to tell. And I'm looking forward to those connections.
Well, at least they're tying stuff together.
Yeah. Yeah. The only other thing they touched on was they mentioned that the next episode, episode 3, will focus on the Klingons heavily with Laurel. And the big focus there is a woman taking command of the Empire, essentially, taking command of Kronos and everything. So kind of topical, which they joked a little bit about. And I'm looking forward to seeing that, because Mary Chifo, who plays Laurel, is just fantastic. And I'm really excited to see where her story is going.
And I guess, you know, it's cool. The only thing, my reaction is a little bit more relaxed, because, you know, when Azit Bor takes over for Gorkon in Undiscovered Country, the Klingons were so, they didn't seem to care that she was female. It seemed like it felt very natural. It felt like, oh, she's taking over the Empire, and there's, like, no resistance to her rule. So it actually led me to believe that they had already had previous female rulers. Maybe Laurel is truly the first one. She is the first one, right?
I mean, it's pre-TOS, so, you know, that's definitely possible. We don't know a whole lot about the Klingon history prior to then, you know, so this is uncharted territory. But I think it's good because it is topical, you know, right now in our climate, that there are still people who have problems with women in power, and I'm excited to see where the show takes that concept.
That's a good point. It's just because I'm such a huge fan of The Expanse, which is loaded with super powerful women, and it's just, they're all so cool. So it's like that, I always end up comparing stuff to The Expanse with how they do it. Ironically, the two from each show are very similar in appearance and combat like capability. That's kind of neat.
I've been meaning to watch that show. I've heard very good things about it.
Well, the books are good and the show is good. I'm not going to spoil anything, but, you know, the lead actor on the show is great, but man, is he annoying. he's one of those, and I love him. He's sharp looking. He's great looking. He's very similar to his book character, but he's always yelling. That's his thing. And his female counterpart is like his, what's it called? Like a muse almost.
Okay.
She kind of keeps him balanced when you realize that he's the leader, but she's the leader behind the curtains and everybody knows it. she keeps him sane and balanced, and she's the strongest character actually on the show. I don't want to spoil anything, because if you haven't seen The Expanse, watch The Expanse.
fair enough. So that's it for The Ready Room, its first episode. They will be premiering episodes every Friday. I assume as long as the show is airing. I don't know if they'll continue it when the show's off the air. They certainly could. There's enough actors and crew and cast members to talk to. But so they post that on the Facebook page for Star Trek Discovery.
Well, you bring up a good point about the Facebook problem. Is Facebook, the way they sort their timeline is such a nightmare that if you miss it and you're trying to find it, it can be a pain to find anything. Every so often I'll see Ray post something about her Patreon or her timeline, and I miss it and I want to go back and find it. Mm-hmm. And even though it's like sort of my most recent, it's like the top post is like 3 weeks old. I'm like, what the hell is going on? I just show me the posts chronologically, Facebook. So you're right. That could be a problem if people miss it.
Luckily, if you go straight to the page, the Star Trek Discovery Facebook page, they are chronological there, but I decided to watch it tonight and we were recording on Monday. So it came out on Friday. So there's been like, three solid days in between. So there's other posts I've got to scroll through and stuff. And it's not like it's in a different format than anything else that they post, because they usually post video content more often.
I gotcha.
Than not. That's my only complaint about it. It seems very succinct. It seems like a much more kind of honest concept of what they're trying to do, because I'm the kind of Trekkie that wants to see these interviews. I like the behind the scenes stuff. I like getting tidbits, and I like talking about where things are headed without getting too spoilery. And I want to do it in as honest a way as we can. Obviously, they're not going to have, Alex Kurtzman's not going to come on and trash the show or say anything particularly negative, right? That'd be insane. But it just felt more sincere.
Well, that's important. Fans react to that better than if they feel it's fake. Just like After Trek, nobody watched it.
I mean, that was the problem, right? I mean, I tried it, you tried it, and we didn't last long.
Well, like I said, it's that whole woo factor, Look at the phasers, woo! Look at the ship, woo! I'm like, can we just... did you watch E3 this year?
I did not.
Well, when they were doing the announcements for, like, Fallout 76, mm-hmm. there was somebody in the crowd just... Anytime, this is Fallout set in West Virginia, and they're, woo! And you can use guns, woo! And... The whole time you're like, this is distracting. And that's what After Trek felt like.
Well, yeah. I mean, I really soured when they tried to sell me, and this is not an exaggeration, a Starship model that was $8,000.
Look, I cannot pay my mortgage for 6 months and to buy a model. That's basically the equivalent.
So,
let's talk about New Eden.
Sure, let's do it. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we will talk all about episode 2.
Hey there, I'm Batman, and I wanted to tell you about my friends at the Screen Heroes Podcast. They deliver sweet justice in the form of discussing movies, television, and me. They love my movies, every single one of them. Yes, even that one. Sometimes they even have me on as a guest, which is thrilling. You can find them at twitch.tv/heroespodcasts, live on Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Gotham time. If you can't tune in live, the new shows go up on places like Spreaker, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Gotham Radio, Themyscira Live, and Blog Talk Radio. Now, back to your regularly scheduled Batcast.
All right, and we are back. Derek and I just spent some time talking news, new Ready Room show, but we really want to, the focus of this episode today is New Eden, the second episode of Star Trek Season 2 of Discovery. What do you think, Derek, before we dive into the actual overall plot, on a 1 to 10, what do you think?
On a 1 to 10, that's a great question. I'd probably give it like an 8 or a 9. I really thought it was fantastic. Having only seen it the one time, I don't think I can give it like a 10 because I haven't watched it enough, really, in my opinion. But it was really good. What about you?
I'm with you. It's an eight, a very solid eight to me. It's good. It's good Trek. It felt like good Trek. Again, there's some stuff that, you know, it's that just Trek always does. Discovery just hams it up a little bit more. Is, you know, this signal, the radiation, this radiation, that. But that's fine. It's but the plot. This is going to sound funny. I actually got a pretty significant X-Files vibe when it first opened up.
Oh, I like that.
I think it's because they were doing a little bit more of. It was kind of like a mystery with science. And that's always kind of neat to me. And, you know, X-Files always did a bunch of that. Like, what's going on? But you always have with Scully, who would, you know, I got the vibe of Scully and Mulder, because you have Scully, who's the scientist, like Burnham, always challenging Mulder. And, you know, you have Pike in this episode, who's showing a little bit of his family's religious background. He's not really religious, but he's educated. And he's more willing to take certain things on, whatever, divine action. And Burnham's like, no, there's got to be a scientific explanation. I'm like, that was when I got the X-Files vibe.
I like it. No, I think that's really solid. I did post a Twitter poll. I posted it kind of late, so I apologize to anybody who didn't get to see it. So kind of lower voting numbers than normal. But 63% gave it an A rating, with 38% giving it a B, and nobody gave it lower.
Yeah, I mean, this was not like a bad episode of Star Trek. So I think an eight is an eight or up, an A score is a good score.
Yeah, I like your concept of the X-Files vibes. I definitely see it now that you mention it. It didn't occur to me at the time.
Well, and you know, we don't want to spoil too much. And I know every so often on this show we do a lot of spoiler discussion. So spoiler discussion. They're continuing the search and the investigation on those red signals, the radiation signals and such. And when they detect the second one, it's like, what'd they say, 51,000 light years away?
Right.
And in the beta quadrant, and even Pike, and people have to remember, yes, Next Generation, Voyager and company, they talk about the beta quadrant and how it's well explored, but it's 140 years after original series parts sometimes.
We have to remember that a lot of these ships have a top speed that's a lot lower than the Enterprise D.
Yeah, I mean, there's Warp 7 is a lot of them. Some of them can barely push Warp 8. And so, yeah, when they mention 51,000 light years and they actually talk about, oh, well, we're going to have to use a spore drive, and they're trying to explain it to Pike, and even Pike's, you know, the little joke, he's like, we're going to skip across the galaxy on a mushroom road. He's like, okay. I like that, and that was kind of neat.
He says, you know, he's going to have to just take it on faith, which... Aside from that being just a very reasonable way to look at it, like, I got to trust this crew that they know what the hell they're talking about, it also is just fitting for the episode.
Yes, it is. And something else I really want to emphasize on this episode is it again reinforces the strength of Tilly as a character and as an actress. And, you know, I don't know if... You know, it's starting to get to that point. We talked about this a couple weeks ago, where there's so many characters on the bridge that, you know, they had to have Pike name them all off last week.
Yes.
And I still can't name the whole bridge crew. I'm glad to see them getting other characters involved, because in Next Generation, you had different characters every episode. Same thing with Voyager, same thing with DS9. Because they had Owo is, I think, what people are calling her online.
Oh, Awokasoon.
Awokasoon, yeah.
Awosakoon,
yeah.
Awosakoon. Joanne is her first name, so we can call her Joanne. But yes.
Yeah, but it's so that, you know, they had detected another signal, but when they arrive at the signal location, it's just an M-class planet. And they're all trying to figure out, like, where the hell the signal come from, and... You know, when they're looking into the planet, and again, spoiler alert for those of you who haven't seen it, New Eden, you stop listening now, but essentially they find humans, and they're not the original series human aliens that just look like humans, or Next Generation when it's, you know, Angel One and they look like humans. It's literally humans from the planet Earth on a planet 51,000 light years away from Earth.
It definitely had some TOS vibes, though. Like, you know, they'd go down to the gangster planet, and it's really just Earth. But, you know, it's their budget was so tight, it's just the gangster set from something. It felt very reminiscent of that. which was kind of nostalgic in a way. But I like that they're actually humans. They're actually Earthlings.
Yeah, they didn't try to... This wasn't some species that was cloned to look like humans or something. Like, nope, it's just humans. And, you know, they're not quite living in a primitive society because they have homes and agriculture and such. They're kind of more similar to the I can't even think of the aliens from freaking Insurrection.
Oh, the Baku.
The Baku and the Sona, yeah, because the Sona and the are Baku. But they're kind of like that. So they have some technology and they have some familiarity with stuff. And, you know, they even talk about how they lost power to the church and they've been trying to rebuild it. And, you know, I get the vibe when, you know, Pike, Burnham, and Joanne are investigating the planet and they find the church with all the combined religions. Mm-hmm. That reminds me of that TOS episode where the Yangs and the Coombs.
Oh, right.
He's in the communists because they just had like leftover information. Mm-hmm. And they just tried to cobble it together the best they could. And this episode was a very religious-based episode, especially for mostly secular Star Trek, outside of, you know, the Bajorans. This was very, very, very religious.
Well, I want to touch on that, because a lot of people are talking about this being the first real conversation about science versus faith in Star Trek. And I think people forget how much of Deep Space Nine is that conversation. I mean, in the first episode, Sisko becomes the emissary for the Bajorans
religion
and their entire faith, you know, with the prophets. And that is a thread that goes until literally the end of the series. And the conversation was that battle of the Bajorans believing it to be faith-based for these prophets, to be their gods. And then Sisko, who is the emissary, coming from it from a more scientific standpoint, believing that these are the wormhole aliens, right? And, you know, the concept of something that they talk about here in New Eden is that any abilities, powers, technologies advanced enough, you know, Pike says would be indiscernible from God.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And even the religious aspect of DS9, you remember the Next Generation episode, Who Watches the Watchers with the Bentonkans? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the anthropologists are talking to Picard about, you know, they used to be religious and now they're not, but they're going to start viewing us as a religion. And Picard kind of goes off the rails. He's like, I'm not going to let them fall back into barbarity and depravity or whatever of, you know, inquisitions and religion like that. And that was Picard, because Picard was an intellectual. He knows Earth's history of, you know, again, people sometimes view that stuff and they look at it from 1995 when they're watching the episode. But you have to look at it from somebody in 2367 or 2368. It's like most Catholics and Protestants today, they look back at the 30 Years' War in 1600s. Protestants versus Catholics were, you know, 12 million are killed. And most religious people today agree that that was a bad idea.
I hope so.
They're educated enough to go, that was wrong, the Inquisition was wrong, whatever. That's Picard, who's looking back at thousands of years of human history going, you know, religions on Earth caused a lot of wars, and he didn't want the Metalkans to go through that. And you kind of get that a little bit with Burnham in this episode, where she's like, okay, they got to be here, and there's got to be a logical explanation.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And this really gets to show who Pike is as a captain and as a human being. You know, this episode focuses a lot on General Order Number 1, which it evolves into the Prime Directive.
Yep, and, absolutely.
You know, yeah, all of our captains have broken the Prime Directive from time to time. You could even argue that Pike breaks it at the end of this episode. But the fact that it is so important to him, and that at the same time he's willing to discuss the possibility of this being a faith-based thing, but at the same time recognizing what that could really mean, right? Like saying that an advanced enough species would be indiscernible from God for him means that this could be a godlike creature. I mean, look at Q for a moment. What is something that the stereotypical Western God can do that Q can't.
Play the trumpet and have a mariachi band.
I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, the idea of Q is a being so evolved, so advanced, so powerful that at the end of the day, he could be our God.
Oh, you right? take a species like Q and you drop them into, 1095 Earth when they're talking about the First Crusade, and they're going to think it is God. And if he can just appear and disappear and do this, do that, they're going to think legitimately God has returned.
Go farther back. I mean, you could go back to Old Testament stuff, Moses on the mountain and everything. I mean, if Q came down and transformed into some otherworldly creature and spoke, in a powerful, ear-shattering voice and could make things, create the plagues and things of that nature. I mean, who would question those abilities?
He's saying it was Q that parted the Red Sea.
I mean, I'm saying that it's the same powers that he has.
No, exactly. That's a good point. And that's kind of what this episode revolves around. And, again, this is another episode like last week where the plot advanced a lot, but not a lot happens.
Yes.
Because, they meet a few of the people on the planet and they meet Jacob, who is a descendant from the families that first arrived. And, again, spoiler alert, but basically these people were transported to this planet somehow, and you don't know how. During World War III, they were fighting a battle at a church, defending a church of some kind. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with the lore of World War III and Earth, it was basically the most updated canon. It was kind of a spillover from the eugenics wars, and 600 million people died, and everything fell apart, basically. So these people were fighting in a war and got transported somehow.
It's super fascinating because, yes, okay, they were transported in a church, but these were people from all walks of life, various religions, and you were mentioning how they kind of cobbled it all together, but I'm not sure that has the right connotation to it. It feels, in this episode, feels more artistically sewn together.
Oh, absolutely, because they put everything together for a purpose. The way they kind of, even the language the colonists, the people on the planet, even the language they use during their sermons, it's language that's used from all the different religions, and they're kind of using the best parts of everything.
Right. And I thought that was really interesting, especially the way they showcased, like when Pike's looking at what I'm assuming is some type of Bible scripture book, right? And you can see that it's literally patched together. You look at the stained glass windows and, as Burnham pointed out, they have symbols from various Earth religions. It's a cool thing for me to see because my background is Jewish. My family is Jewish, but I've been an atheist most of my life. And the idea of all of these religions living in harmony, working together to better everyone, is pretty amazing to me. That's a really appealing concept.
Oh yeah, because I was raised Catholic. been primarily in, similar to you, just more of an atheist in my adult life. But yeah, this would be the best peaceful teachings of all the religions are what the people on the planet appear to be living with. And even when, Jacob is trying to explain to the elder, like, look, there's something about these people. Look at this. The elder doesn't respond to Jacob with like anger, which happened, in a lot of those TNG episodes when the supreme ruler is talking to the young wild scientist and berating the scientist and all that jazz. Mm-hmm. The elder doesn't do that. The elder just says, Jacob, your place is here and this is our life and this is our home. But she's very kind. She's very calm. She's very relaxed. She's not over the top. You and your false science have doomed us.
The thing is, you have to think about what these people have gone through. They were literally teleported in the middle of a war zone to a peaceful planet. And given, what to anybody should appear to be a second chance at a better life, to avoid the violence and mistakes of their generation and those before them. So the idea of going back is probably not particularly appealing to these people now. It's been 100 years.
It's their home.
Or,
I mean,
not 100 years, 300 years.
Yeah. I mean, it's their home. People don't want to leave. And, you know, at the same time they're on the planet, you've got the radiation issue with the one of the rings, because the planet's kind of got like a cool trinary ring system. And one of the rings, naturally, of course, you know, in 1 hour, there's going to be a radiation storm. It's going to destroy the planet. Of course, right? And that's when Saru hypothesizes. He's like, did the signal bring us, like, in what'd he say? They were like, the signal inspired us to come here to save this planet. We're not going to let a planet be destroyed on our watch.
Right. Because, you know, even though on the bridge, you've got people from different planets that, you know, clearly would not have the same religion, whether they're religious or not, they all still believe that they should do the best they can in any opportunity that, in any situation that they're put into. And whether or not the red dots or this angelic being shape form that Burnham saw is intelligent, an alien, a god or not, it doesn't matter, because they have an opportunity to save people.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And, you know, and on the ship, you know, they find a way to kind of intercede on behalf of the planet to save it. And they use the dark matter asteroid because of the intense gravity after Tilly, you know, takes off a 1 centimeter chunk and hurts herself because it explodes and almost kills her, by the way. And then she starts seeing, you know, we'll talk about that in a minute. But so Discovery is able to save the day, of course, and beam the people up after Pike again gets injured, which is going to be a running gag this season, I'm assuming, that something's going to happen to him every episode, right?
I mean, it was fun to see the away party consist of two very important bridge officers. I mean, that's not true. All three of them are bridge officers, but two of them being leads on the show, right? You've got the captain, you've got Burnham, who is the lead, right? And then you have Wosakun, who's another bridge officer. You know, and all three of them go down. It's the Kirk, Spock, and Bones thing all over again.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, so much stuff happens. And the one complaint I had for Tilly is, you know, when Tilly's hypothesizing how to solve the problem, she, you know, she's like, "Oh, I wish Michael was here." And I'm like, "I wish," because they've done that a few times. And I'm like, "No, just Tilly, you're great at what you do. Just let yourself be yourself." And the reason I say that is, you remember those TNG episodes when, you know, they run into those like filaments and crushers on the bridge and she's like in charge?
Yeah.
And people are like questioning her, and then her confidence starts building up. She's like, "Wait, the captain's not here. Riker's not here. I'm going to solve it." And she starts figuring out people's strengths. And I like that. I like when, and they kind of do that where, you know, she's talking to her friend and her friend's kind of encouraging her, because, you know, Tilly needs the encouragement. But man, I wish she would have said, "Oh, you know, Burnham's not here, but you know what? I'm going to figure this out anyways." And I just, because I want the characters to be good on their own, if that makes sense.
Well, and I think she will. I think it's a matter of time. As we continue to know her, she gains more and more confidence as time goes on, right? Like, you know, in the first episode, she's joking about being drunk with power, because why? Well, she's in the command program now. She in this episode, she's questioning or flat out ignoring Saru's orders. And, you know, she's getting hurt in the process, but she's also saving the day in the process. And it's showing that she is making strides. She's becoming a better officer. She's becoming a more confident human being. And the fact that she's still in her head, her reflex is to fall back on somebody. While we may not want her to do that, I do think it's pretty normal. It's pretty human when you're a person who had self-esteem issues or had low confidence issues. And I think soon-ish, that won't be a roadblock for her anymore.
I hope not, because especially everything she went through in season one. Mm-hmm. I mean, hell, she pretended to be, you know, Killy. So it's like, it's one of those things I hope they just continue to let, like, we've seen so much growth in Saru, as like an officer, as a captain. And we're starting to see some with Tilly, but we're still seeing a lot of those confidence things, which I know people are trying to prescribe to a whole bunch of variety of reasons. It's just, he's such a good character. I hope that the showrunners realize the talent they have in that actress and let it blossom.
Yeah, Mary Wiseman's great. There's no question in my mind about that. I just think they're really using her to show what would somebody like you or me be like on that ship, you know? And she's absolutely brilliant, but at the same time, she's young. She's the youngest person ever accepted into the command program at that particular point in Starfleet's history.
Yeah, which I have very little information on other people who've been accepted into that at a young age. So, I mean, it makes sense. She was pretty integral in helping end the war. So, I mean, if anybody deserves an early entry, it's her.
Either way, though, I mean, when you're the youngest to get to do something, you know, you usually fall into one of two categories. You're either overconfident and cocky, which can lead to problems, or you're self-conscious and have, you know, feelings of imposter syndrome or something like that. And I think that one can show, that's a little less tropey to show than the over-cocky person who has to get knocked down a peg.
Well, yeah, because the over-cocky thing is always played out quite a bit on most on non-Star Trek shows. It's all over the place.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's been on Star Trek. I mean, Tom Paris was the overly cocky flyboy, right?
Yeah, I mean, even in episode one this year, you had Connolly, just a jerk of a scientist, the science officer, who was just overly brash and arrogant about everything.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, we get to see, I mean, Tilly comes onto the bridge in the medical gown, whatever you'd want to call that, doesn't really worry about the appearance or worry about barging in or anything like that, because she thinks she has the answer to something that's incredibly important. And it caught some of the bridge crew members off guard, but what does Saru do? He listens to her. He stops. Yep. He hears what she says and he listens to it. And that's also what makes him a good commander.
No, I completely agree with that. And I like how she just immediately runs to the bridge. It's, hey, I think I can solve this. I think I know a solution. I'm going to the bridge. She didn't run to get a uniform on or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
She said, screw it. This is important for the mission, important for the crew, and I can save the people of the planet and save our crew that are on the ground. So again, yeah. it just reinforces that she's probably still my favorite overall character on the show. Because even the whole thing with the asteroid is she's trying to use it to find a way to help Stamets. Because she can see the discomfort on Stamets when he's talking about entering the mycelial spore system. And he's like, I don't know what I'm going to do if I see Hugh again. Mm-hmm. It's like she's reacting to the pain of others to try to help solve it. I mean, that's not only is that integral Starfleet, that's a very human thing to want to do, to take care of your friends and colleagues.
Absolutely. Yeah, I still have a very hard time picking a favorite character. I tend to gravitate towards the non-humans in Star Trek, so like Saru, for example. But there's just, everybody is so strong, and they don't really focus on too many of them all at once. It's hard to pick for me.
Yeah, I think the main reason I'm still with Tilly is she's just the one that's so relatable that I can relate to the easiest.
Yeah,
and maybe it's because she just feels so human, and you know, it's. Burnham's a brilliant, but the thing is, Burnham kind of reminds me of Next Generation, where she's almost so good at everything. And that's the joke about Next Generation. You and I have made that joke. Mm-hmm. But Tilly's kind of got like human characteristics, human flaws. And I get it because Burnham was raised as a Vulcan, raised on Vulcan. But I don't know, and we'll see. And it's, I always dig those very real, those characters that feel like, if I encountered them in Starfleet, that I would feel natural being around.
Sure. Absolutely. So talking about Tilly does lead us to a new character that we were introduced to named May.
Yes. May. So again, huge spoiler alert, because the only way we can talk about this character is if we admit that there's spoilers.
No, I mean, I feel like at this point, yeah, it's all, everything's been spoiled. So.
Everything's been spoiled. Yeah. I mean, she's, she's seeing one of her friends from middle school, high school. Mm-hmm. And the friend turns out she does some research. She thinks the friend's on board, but the friend died like 10 years in the past. And she's seeing a full life-size image of this girl in a Discovery uniform who's been giving Tilly advice like during the episode and giving her feedback and giving her support. No, I know that there's some discussion that it's an image from the mycelial spore network, because that spore landed on her like in an episode last year.
Mm.
And so maybe it's drawing on one of her memories, but who knows? It could be related to this whole angel thing that we've been seeing.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's also, you know, the fact that she was hit with that explosion, so or whatever that was, from the asteroid that had dark matter involved. You know, we, as a species, we know very little about dark matter, so sci-fi can play around with that really quite a bit. The way May was introduced as a character just really caught me off guard, because we didn't get a name. We didn't get an introduction. She's just there talking to Tilly. Like, they've been talking together for years, and we're just rolling with it. And I was really confused by that at first. I was like, well, this is an interesting way to introduce a new character.
Well, especially because she meets her in sick bay, and everybody's mm-hmm. wearing the white medical uniform except for May.
Right.
She's the only one in the blue disco uniform, and she's just talking to Tilly while Tilly's doing her thing. And, you know, I mean, we'll see, because I have my own theory. Well, not my own. There's a pretty common theory about the Red Angel thing. The whole connection to the Iconians or the Preservers or something.
Oh, yes. I would love to talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, I know people want them to introduce a new species, but I actually would prefer if they don't introduce new species, because Star Trek's got enough of these magical species. They don't need to keep creating new ones.
Well, I think if you're going to have a season-long arc that that connects the whole galaxy and is clearly showing like a scavenger hunt for the crew here, right? Like, the idea that we're supposed to come out of this episode with is that they were supposed to get that asteroid. That they were supposed to get that asteroid and take it to that planet at that particular point in time to save those people.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, to do all of that and to create a creature that looks like that form, that angelic form that we saw, and have it not be the Iconians or not be something that we have some familiarity with would be surprising. Now, if they create something new, they create something new. But I think the Iconian idea is super interesting.
Well, and especially with how big the Iconians have been in Star Trek Online lately, and even the artwork of the Iconians, there's a lot, and again, it could just be the ICs with the ICs, but there's a lot of similarity between them.
I think, additionally, they're working on the Picard show, and we know that he's not captain anymore. That phase of his life is over. Jonathan Frakes confirmed that. Most of us kind of guessed it, that this would be a non-captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Mm-hmm.
And Jean-Luc has always had a fascination with artifacts, right? And he always had a fascination with the Iconians.
Yeah, I mean, they even encountered one of the Iconian computer systems that destroyed the Yamato. So
what if there's a connection here?
There very well might be. And, you know, the true canon information we have on the Iconians is thankfully so minimal. Yeah, we've got some stuff in Star Trek Online and such. But, you know, everybody was talking about, you know, they were wiped out by a whole bunch of species. Maybe they were evil. And then somebody on the show is like, well, you don't know if they were evil. The history about them was written by the people who destroyed them.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And, you know, while Star Trek Online has been able to expand on the lore, at the end of the day, and I hate to say it, that game is not canon. So we really only have very few pieces of canon information about the Iconians.
Yeah, there's a bunch of beta canon, but little alpha canon.
And you mentioned the Preservers, who, you know, they have a bunch of stuff in beta canon because of the novels, and they're super interesting. You know, they could go that route, especially because the Preservers are also responsible for the Mirror Universe.
Well, and, you know, there's a history of the Preservers, because in the original series, when they saved, I think it was like three of those Native American tribes. So there's established lore of them doing that. Maybe there was something special about these people, or maybe it was because the group was very diverse and very diverse culturally that they were saved. The Iconian thing would be kind of neat because it's a fun Easter egg, but it's still within the realm of Star Trek. Because the risk you run if you create yet another new meta species, you know, the Particularians or something, it's then everybody runs into the question, like, why have we never heard of them before?
Right.
You know, if you use the Iconians, you know, 100, 200 years down the road, when somebody's looking through these logs, like, oh, we understand the Star Trek Discovery thought they met an Iconian, but it was never confirmed.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think it'd be a missed opportunity to not tie into some Star Trek lore, because it seems that that's what they're doing. It seems like they're doing this stuff on purpose. And the people involved in the show know Star Trek. You know, it's one thing to not like their take on it, but claiming these people don't know the franchise is just disingenuous. And so I'd be surprised if this doesn't connect to something we already know.
I am completely on board with that. And it's, maybe it's the Iconians, maybe it's the Preservers, maybe it's, I hope it's not something where it's, they pull an Interstellar where it's future humans testing current humans or something. I'm like, no, let's not, let's not do that. I love Interstellar, but even I thought that was kind of lazy.
No, I don't see that happening here, because that would violate the temporal prime directive. And by the way, would show echoes of the temporal Cold War from Enterprise, which I don't think anybody really wants to do.
Yeah. Let's not revisit that one.
So
it's okay to admit certain stories don't work.
And not to go off on too much of a tangent here, but I have so many gripes about Interstellar, man.
I'm with you, buddy. but I still enjoy it, but yeah, I got plenty of gripes too. But
so it's a pretty movie.
It's a very pretty movie. But that's the weird thing about New Eden, is like we just said again, like a lot of stuff happens to advance the plot, but not a lot of individual stuff happens. You know, they saved the planet, they meet some people. Pike wildly violates General Order 1 by leaving behind a little battery pack. But essentially all the battery pack does is give him power for their church, which used to have power anyways.
Well, and that's the thing. He knows that Jacob knows their old technology. His family line has been responsible for that technology. And this is kind of the parting gift of all the fruits of their labor of doing that for generations.
Yeah, it's, you know, just
for the 200 years or so, and I know I accidentally said 300 before, but the 200 years or so that they were there, you know, this is the thanks, is to make that power work, to show that Earth got by, but maybe that doesn't mean they need to leave their home.
Yeah, that's a very good point. They can build a new home, and again, that's the one problem with the prequel is, you know, now people are going to ask, like, what are they like 200 years later? What are they like 100 years later? Did this planet join the, well, 51,000 light years would be too far to join the Federation, but what ended up happening to the people? That's just Trek fans. We're curious about everything. We want to, you know, CBS, you have to realize that by now. You put anything on a show, we're going to ask questions about it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
There's thousands of Wikipedia pages on starships alone.
Now, one thing we didn't touch on yet is the donut in space.
Do we want to touch on it?
I mean, I think a little bit for two main reasons. One, first and foremost, it shows us more about Detmer, who, you know, other than the injury that she has in the beginning of the series, we don't get to know much about her. You know, we know that she's front and center. She's the helms officer on board the Discovery, so she's got to be pretty good, but that's all we really know. And this episode lets us learn that she's not just a pilot, she's a fantastic pilot, she is one of the best pilots, right? Which it may be a little tropey for Trek, because like you mentioned, TNG is a little like that. You know, Tom Paris on Voyager is the greatest pilot of all time, and you know, but in this case, we get to learn a little bit more about Detmer. She's had her pilot's license since she was 12.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's, you know, she's willing to try some crazy stuff.
Well, I guess if you think about it, we've had Tom Paris and Detmer, but, you know, on Next Generation, they kind of just threw anybody in a red shirt at the helm's control. And, you know, Wesley Crusher, yeah, he served at the helm, but I think everybody knows Wesley Moore as a science background.
That's true.
He was smart. And yeah, you had Sulu and Chekhov that on the original series kind of swapped roles now and then, mm-hmm. just depending on who was doing what. Detmer is really the second one we've had that I would consider a true... I mean, you had on Enterprise, but I think Detmer takes a little bit more precedence. And I at least like that, again, it's Star Trek and they're trying to keep some reality of what physics is, which I always appreciate because it's so easy just to pretend that physics doesn't matter when it's probably the one of the universal constants of the galaxy.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the second part kind of comes into this, is that, I mean, I'm not a physicist in any respect, so I don't really know. It felt a little silly when they actually did the donut.
Well, this is going to sound weird. When they said they were going to be doing a donut, I thought they were literally going to, like, spin in a circle.
I know, me too.
I was like, because whenever I've done a donut driving, like, on accident, my car spins. And maybe it was just because of the camera angle, but it didn't look like... I thought they were going to spin to build up centrifugal force to throw the asteroid. Because they said early on, you know, they couldn't really... When they caught the asteroid, that it, transporters and the tractor beam wasn't going to work on it. So that's what I thought they were going to do, build up enough centrifugal force to literally throw the asteroid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm with you. And that's not really what it looked like. It looked a little slow even. I think in my head, because the production value is so high on this show, I guess I expected something a little more sophisticated from a visual FX standpoint.
You remember A New Hope when the Millennium Falcon's being chased? And he's like, oh, watch this. And he just does no movement at all. And they even make fun of it on Family Guy. And the Imperials are like, where'd he go? I don't know. It kind of felt like that.
To the left.
Yeah. It kind of felt like that a little bit. They're talking up this big thing, and a culvert starburst maneuver this was not. I'm breaking out that reference.
I mean, yeah, that's exactly my thought on that. So it has nothing to do with the Detmer character. It has more to do with just the visual effects of that shot, that sequence.
Well, and you know, we got a little bit more dialogue from Miriam finally. You know, she gave a little bit of feedback to Saru and company, so that was kind of cool to have her more engaged. But that's the problem with when you have a cast this large with this many people and you're trying to exemplify modern television, it's hard to give everybody equal distance, like equal feed or equal opportunity on a show to show what they can do.
Yeah.
And especially if you only have 12 to 14 episodes a season, you can't highlight everybody. And that's one of the big complaints about Game of Thrones is, you know, this character's content was cut as the seasons went on. And they're like, well, we have so much going on, we can't film everybody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Detmer's cool looking and Miriam is cool looking and Saru's neat. And you got all these secondary characters that are the fans love. Cause that seems to be what fans do. We love those secondary characters we want to know more about.
And I'm sorry. Do you mean Arium?
Arium. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. Sorry. I thought maybe I was missing somebody. So I just wanted to.
No, I was just Miriam. I don't know why. Arium.
Okay. Yeah.
She was more involved, which is neat. And we didn't see the red shirt engineer from last episode.
It's true. We didn't.
Maybe she went back to the Enterprise. I don't know.
Maybe. That's definitely possible. And, you know, like I said earlier, I tend to gravitate towards the non-human. So I want to see more of Arium because she seems cool. Like she is an android, but is she, you know, where did she come from? Is she from a planet of living mechanical beings, you know, that aren't, you know, like us? Was she built by another Federation planet? Like what's her background? I really want to know.
Yeah, because it's one of those things they're gonna have to be careful when, you know, if they start using the word android and everybody's like, well, the Soong type androids were the first positronic androids.
Well, maybe she's not positronic.
Yeah, maybe she's something else. Like you said, right. I'm hopeful maybe she's just some sort of cyborg enhanced species, which would be a good contrary to the Borg, where the Borg want to consume everybody. Maybe this species just uses it to enhance, you know, maybe they have a low gravity, weak atmosphere environment or something. So they use cybernetics to enhance themselves.
Maybe.
You had Melora Paslar on DS9, that the girl that came from the low gravity planet where they could fly.
Right. Yeah.
but they worked on a system to enhance it so she could walk and work on a Starfleet vessel.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, maybe it's something like that. They just enhance themselves a little bit.
Very possible.
Or she's just a full robot species and they're pretty neat looking.
So, let's see. Not a whole lot else. You know, not much from Stamets. He used the spore drive again, which was kind of a touching scene because he was really concerned he was going to see Culber in the spore network because that's where he saw him last. Which was a pretty emotional scene, and obviously we don't get to see Culber in this particular episode. Still holding out hope that we'll get to see more of him.
Yeah, somebody mentioned his name was even off the credits this time.
It was. Yeah, that's always a frustration for me is opening credits, because if you're not going to just always show the exact same people, it's kind of a spoiler for the episode you're about to watch.
Absolutely.
You know, so when I saw Culber's name in the credits of the first episode of Brother, I was like, oh, okay, so he's still a series regular. Well, then this week his name's not in the credits. I'm like, okay. So I guess that just means his contract has his name in the opening credits when he's in an episode. But that means now we'll know if he's going to be in one if his name shows up in the credits.
Yeah, which...
Or vice versa.
Yeah, it makes it difficult to do some surprises these days, but it's just like with the Marvel movies. They're like, oh, is Robert Downey Jr. done playing Iron Man? And then the Disney CFO people announce that he signs a 5-movie contract extension. You're like, well, apparently he's not. So he's not actually dead. And that's the problem with modern contracting, is that it's so hard to keep secrets.
It is. But I mean, like, we don't know the contracts of these cast members, you know? So if you just kept the names off the opening credits, then we'd have no way of knowing if they're going to show up or not.
That's right.
You know, that's my gripe. You know, and Star Trek has always done this, where you know, the opening credits are like, and special guest star, you know, Whoopi Goldberg. Like, well, I guess Guinan's in this one.
You know? There's no mystery here.
Right. And, you know, sometimes that can be distracting. You know, there's been movies where there's, you know, the opening credits is some actor I had no clue was in the film. And now I'm like, well, where is he? I'm going to keep looking for him or whatever. In this case, you know, when you have a character who dies in such a intense and shocking way, and then there's all these rumors that, you know, he's in this season, and the first time you see him, he is, but it's a recording, so it's from before he died, you know, and then he's not in the second episode, you start to kind of question what the plan is, and now I'm going to be looking for it. I can't help it. If I see his name in the credits, like, I'm going to be looking for it.
Yeah, and I know we're running long here, but the last thing I want to mention is a comment that Stamets and Tilly were talking about, how they mycelium network is basically could be like a rebirth, because mm-hmm. nothing in the universe ever dies. That's fascinating, and I like it, but I hope they don't find some cheesy way of killing characters off and just bringing them back from the network, or bringing them back from the mycelium network, because I think character deaths, if done on a story, can be very dramatic and done and have important impacts. And it's like, Deanna, Tasha Yar, you know, yeah, she was leaving, and people knew she was leaving the show, but nobody knew they were going to kill her.
Mm-hmm.
Especially from a tar monster, but whatever.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that if they're going to use that mechanic to bring back Culber, they have to do it in a way where it's a one-time deal.
Or they have to do, you know, Babylon 5 had this thing where, yeah, I'm referencing Babylon 5. I'm going ultra nerd mode today. There was an episode of Babylon 5 that there was an alien healing machine that was found, and you hook two people up to it, but the way it heals is it drains my life and gives it to you, basically, because what they found out was the machine was a death penalty machine, so it was used to take life from criminals to give life to the good people.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that's something that Stamets figures out with the network, is, hey, I found a way to bring back Culber, but, you know, that old adage of only life can pay for life, so I would have to die for Culber to come back.
So I had a similar idea. I have not seen Babylon 5. I've always wanted to. But the Flash TV show has a similar concept to the Spore Network, which is the Speed Force. And there's a whole arc in the show about how the Speed Force is kind of like a living thing, and there's a balance to it. And they do some stuff to kind of trick the Speed Force, and it creates a problem. There's an imbalance. And somebody has to fill a void in the Speed Force. And, you know, one character has to sacrifice themselves for another character to be trapped in there.
Hmm. So yeah, that could be pretty similar to what they're going to do with this. And maybe that's why the Spore Drive ends up being a buried Federation secret.
I mean, it's definitely possible. You know, having Stamets sacrifice himself for Culber because he can't live without him, I think, is a very touching thing. At the same time, I'm sure Culber would be very upset by that.
Well, and it also gives a good reason why the Federation would hide the technology, because you would have lunatics out there that, you know, lose a husband or a wife or a child and get so desperate that they kidnap somebody of force and whatever. They somehow force them to trade spots or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You would have that. And we'll see. They're setting something up, that's for sure.
Yeah, no question. No question at all.
I think we beat on New Eden pretty good. A good episode. I think better than the first one. So I'm glad to see some of our fan favorite characters starting to get a lot of the limelight, and obviously everybody loves Pike still.
Oh yeah, he's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Next week we have the episode 3 is called Point of Light.
Point of Light.
Point of Light.
Hmm.
Yeah, this season's episode titles are less TOS like. They're much shorter. They're more succinct. Brother, New Eden, Point of Light. I know the next two, but I'll save those for future weeks.
Yeah, we got plenty more Trek to talk about. I have to admit that this, before we end, I like this whole Red Angel thing they're doing, because even though I'm not religious, I appreciate mysticism and lore and otherworldly stuff in Star Trek, because it's something that forces the cast and crew to respond to. Because, you know, my big complaint about 2009 movies and some modern movies these days, or 2009 Trek, is everything is a gigantic blue monster space beam.
Mm-hmm.
Or gigantic, let's build a dreadnought with 85 torpedoes on it and have no other plot. And so I like stories that have impact on the cast and crew. So I'm enjoying this so far.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you. Anything that deals with the classic pillars of Star Trek, you know, ethics, morals, philosophy, the human experience, right? That's the whole point. What does it mean to be human? And ignoring religion and faith is ignoring most of our history.
Yeah, and that's one thing I loved about Burnham in this episode, was her sticking to her science background. Mm-hmm. You know, Pike is saying this out of the other, and she's like, no, there has to be some sort of logical explanation. And she's even challenging the people on the planet. I'm like, that's what a scientist would do.
It is.
They don't just take something at face value. They're like, all right, I need more information.
I think that's what we're going to continue to get. It's just more detail as the season goes on.
I agree, buddy. I think this is a good ending point. If you want to talk Star Trek New Eden, you can find us on RedShirtsPod on Twitter. So, or at Heroes Podcast Network on Twitter. Also, you can just search that on Facebook. But Derek, buddy, if people want to find you individually, how can they do that?
I am the Star Trek Dude on Twitter and Facebook. Please come talk to me about Trek, video games, movies. I also co-host Screen Heroes, which is our flagship movie TV podcast here on the Heroes Podcast Network. So come talk with me.
And you can find me on Twitter at @the_bittersteel. And some other good news I've noticed is, if you just go to Google and just type in Red Shirts and Runabouts or Heroes Podcast Network, you're going to find our information.
Woo.
And I know some people like to do that. It's easy to remember. Check us out. You know, this is episode 58, so we've got plenty of Star Trek content. But otherwise, I think we're looking forward to week number 3.
Yes. One other thing I just want to throw out there, I'll probably mention a few more times, is if you are in the Kansas City area for Planet Comic-Con, which is the last weekend of March, we will be doing a live episode of Red Shirts and Runabouts at the convention. We will be doing it on Saturday, and we will be building the ultimate Star Trek crew with the audience.
Sounds excellent.
So yeah, so that'll be it for us then, guys. Hopefully you can join us for that. If not, you can catch us next week when we review episode 3.
See you then.
Red Shirts and Runabouts is part of the Heroes Podcast Network and is executive produced by me, Derek Mayer. Our music is by Flying Killer Robots. Please consider following us on social media at RedShirtsPod on Twitter or at Heroes Podcasts on Facebook, Instagram, Twitch, or Patreon. You can also go to heroespodcast.com to find all of the episodes for Red Shirts and Runabouts, as well as the other shows on the Heroes Podcast Network. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Blog Talk Radio, Google Play, or anywhere that you want to drop our RSS feed. If you drop us a review on iTunes, we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. Thanks for tuning in. Live long and prosper.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.